The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Hi, I'm David Hunter, and I'm an international criminal law professor most of the time. One of my resource professor, or not much answer, I guess. To issues that I work on as environments, and before I came to the nonprofit environmental here. So, I'm talking about human rights from the perspective of the what it looked like for environmentalists. In the international, so I can say something about the international environmental system first. We have, we're very fortunate, we have about a dozen treaties. We're very proud of our treaties, but we don't have any overarching set of binding norms like in the human rights area you have the UN Declaration on Human Rights. And we also don't have any anything that even remotely sounds like the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights or the Inter-American Court on Human Rights. We have no court on the environment anywhere in global governance. We have no commission program, the United Nations Environment Program. But you can just tell by the names that the idea that we might have a court or something that you can go and enforce one of our treaties. And our treaties are all, we like to think of them as very broad, and they are in some respects, but they're also very narrow compared to what the Human Rights Fora and this declaration has. Ours deals specifically with the conservation of biodiversity or with these 12 chemicals over here, and they don't fit together all very well. So when we as environmentalists look out at the human rights system, we are a little bit jazzed because you guys have this, this broad set of principles, and then there's these things called courts and commissions and tribunals and things that look like you could actually practice something that looks like law. And so we get excited about that because we're dealing with scientists and engineers and technical people and policy. So looking from our perspective, the human rights field looks really interesting. And starting about 15 years ago, 20 years ago, as the international environmental activism started to go global, we also started to look at human rights as a possible strategy that maybe we could take advantage of these tribunals and commissions and these things that sounded like they could really use something that looked like a legal hammer to get what we wanted. And so that was one thread of our sort of looking at human rights. The other thread that forced us to look at human rights in part was this tactical, strategic one. And the other one, which was also strategic and tactical, wasn't so analytical. It was that when you went down to the fields of the oil wells in Ecuador, and for example, to look at the environmental contamination, and you went to study the epidemiology or brought down your scientists to look at the health impacts, you were, as I was, stopped by the military, you weren't allowed to take photographs, the people were complaining of severe political oppression, you couldn't speak out, you had to lie about why you were there, and this was repeated in many different areas. So the other reason why environmentalists got drawn into thinking about human rights and the environment was not only that we kind of analytically were jealous, but also that you couldn't separate on the ground the human rights violations from the environmental violations, even if you wanted to. And so if you were like me, completely untrained in human rights, but you walked into the field and you were met with all these things, then you suddenly had to at least become cognizant of what was going on, and then as a strategy you might find you had another forum. In fact, I got an email from an environmental law professor just yesterday, not a professor, an activist, just yesterday, saying, I got this case that I think involves transboundary water pollution, water issues between Brazil and Bolivia, and it's a dam. And do you know anybody who knows transboundary pollution issues that could help me? And by the way, it seems like it's going to affect some indigenous peoples. And I kind of laughed at this because you know, I've done this long enough and you're right. My first thought was, you know, forget the transboundary water issue, which is going to run into some problems. Let's look at the human rights aspects of this group of indigenous people that are going to be affected, or let's look at both at the same time. And, you know, I nailed them back and said, you may want to look as much for expert in human rights as for as in water, transboundary water law. These two always go hand in hand. He wrote back saying, you know, I didn't think of this. He's not a very good environmental lawyer. So, you know, this is sort of the framework. Now, how does it play itself out? Well, it plays itself out in a couple of ways. Let me take first the sort of global strategy of looking for a commission or a place to and thinking about the human rights tribunals. And I'll use the example of climate change. When the Bush administration in 2001, in February of 2001, said we're no longer going to participate in the global climate regime, the Kyoto Protocol, we're going to deal with opportunities through further research and voluntary action. We don't want any targets and tables. A bunch of environmental lawyers got together and said, this is ridiculous. It's clear we're not going to be able to continue negotiations. Where are the forums that we can start to push climate change issues from a lawyer's litigation perspective? And we started listing them in this room. And you know, we explored, could we try to use the WTO on fossil fuel subsidies? Let's get somebody to research that. Is there a way to bring an action to the World Bank Inspection Panel around climate? Let's think about the barriers to that. Somebody to research that. What about using domestic common law? And people went off with that. And these spun off into strategies. And one of the strategies was, well, let's, you know, there's commissions and there's courts and there's human rights, and let's look into that. And that spun off over the course of a couple of years. People were assigned to kind of research that, think about that. And so they did it systematically. They started to look at what are the human rights issues that are raised by climate change. In 2002, they identified in this hemisphere the impact on the Inuit that live in the far north, and the fact that this is climate change is already affecting villages up there, that they were being forced to move. Am I supposed to be there?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah.
And so, researching this in terms of sort of rights and the impact on the Inuit in terms of how does this fit within the legal doctrines of human rights? And they came up with a petition brought by the Inuit, the leader Sheila Wakfudiyeh, who started to talk about what was happening to them from climate change in rights-based discourse. So it didn't interfere with the right to life, to pursue their culture, that in some ways was a form of indirect cultural genocide. And not only did they bring this language to the climate negotiations, which forced negotiators to have to confront real-life victims and people whose rights actually were being, you know, the right to live the way they wanted to was going to be impacted. But they also brought it formally to the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights in a very well-researched petition in which they alleged violations of a bunch of different, mostly economic and social and cultural rights. And the upshot of that petition was that they got a lot of press and publicity about their concerns. The commission didn't want to outright reject it, but shifted it over into holding a day-long seminar, open seminar with the commission to explore the relationship between climate change and human rights, essentially putting that issue on the OAS agenda for human rights. It's not clear where that will go. That just took place about 8 or 9 months ago. And since then, they've held a second one relating to indigenous, or prior informed consent and indigenous people's rights, which are also related to the environment. So that's sort of, you know, kind of strategically thinking, how can we bring environmental issues to these things called courts and tribunals? On the local level, there's lots of cases where the two blend together, and I'll just mention two, but you can look them up. One has been a very interesting competition, some of you may have heard about it, between Uruguay and Argentina, involving two pulp and paper mills. You know, that's just a classic, straight, transboundary environmental issue. There's Uruguay wants to build two pulp and paper mills. and the pollution is going to go downstream and downwind over to Argentina. So we have lots of rules about trying to deal with that. But the people who were really incensed in the beginning about it wasn't actually the governor of Argentina so much as it was the communities that were living downstream. And one thing about human rights, as opposed to trying to bring an international environmental law complaint, is that they can go to the commission or to the court on their own accord. And so they had several strategies. In fact, they did anything. They used any strategy that they had available to them, including trying to go to the OAS. They used local court. And they put those arguments in rights-based language about how the pollution was going to affect their right to health and right to livelihood. They also, and this is relatively unique, they also managed to have to lift it up to being something that the government of Argentina was also concerned about, and they actually brought a world court case against Uruguay, basing mostly on the international environmental issues. And so then you've got actually about six or seven different fora working at the same time with slightly different approaches to the same set of facts, and basically a pollution problem. So this is how human rights and environment get integrated. And you can go and find out all the different tactics that this environmental group and human rights group by going to the website of CEDHA, CEDHA.org. And that stands for essentially the Center for Environment and Human Rights, which also shows you how groups start to get integrated. There's several groups that have explicitly integrated their approach. And this group is one of them, founded by an LLM from a former graduate of the school. Another one is Earth Rights International, and I'll mention that as this kind of example. Earth Rights is also trying to, it is by its name, integrating the idea of human rights and environmental issues together, and also by their actions. So their first case that they got involved in, well-known case involving Burma, and UNICAL's building of a pipeline into Burma. And initially, they thought that as much as an environmental issue as a human rights issue. But as they worked on it, the one strategy that they started to move forward on was the Alien Tort Claims Act. And for reasons that I won't go into now, you probably will hear about it in other places, but the Alien Tort Claims Act, which requires a violation of international law, and because in environmental law we don't have as clear a set of norms and principles, and they're not quite as deeply rooted in the history of international law, it's harder to bring a claim under the ATPA based purely on environmental violations. So the case really moved to being primarily focused on issues around forced slavery, that they were going in with gunpoint, and you know, they go into a village and they say, the Burmese military would say, you there, you're going to come and build my pipeline, you're going to come and build the pipeline, you're going to help build pipeline, and if you don't do it, then I'm going to shoot your child over here, and I'm going to, or I'm going to beat you until you do it. And so there were allegations of murder, a child had been kicked into the fire, rape, and then slavery. And these are very core international law components, and they form the core of using the Alien Tort Claims Act to sue UNICAL. Now, the other piece of that is that UNICAL had an agreement with the military to provide security, and so as part of the proof, they had to show that security of the pipeline, that UNICAL knew or should have known that they, in fact, were going to lead to human rights violations or violations of international environmental law. They dropped the international environmental law aspects because they didn't think that they would prevail under our rules of ATCA, and it went on as a strict human rights case, leading to the first major settlement of a U.S. company settling for human rights and environmental law, in the case of essentially just human rights, for human rights violations committed totally abroad. And I'm going to graphic, how was it? Thank you. These guys aren't very good. That's why I walked in here, they couldn't stop it. This is the last piece of it. You can't stop it, big hook. So this is another big area of sort of where, from the ground up, sort of working on, going in and working on specific issues, you find that there are the two get interrelated. And the very last thing I'll say is the third area where they get interrelated, but this won't take about 30 seconds, is often, as well, when you go into an area as an environmental activist, your human rights may also be put at risk. And this is the other way that environmental groups have unfortunately had to get involved. So a very famous case 10 years ago involving Alexander Nikitin from Russia, who was in jail for under a law that had never been published for complaining about nuclear secrets, about nuclear waste flowing into the North Sea. Right now, there's a man on trial in Ethiopia facing a death sentence for essentially for treason, as basically what it's called, for speaking out against environmental aspects of going on there. And these things happen quite a bit, where the threats come and the civil and political rights are threatened. And in fact, there's a group called Environmental Legal Defender's Office that works specifically on this issue of protecting environmental leaders in other countries whose human rights are being violated, etc. In this way, there's just one more way that we're all working together. I have, what, 2 minutes left, Emily?
Yeah, that was perfect.
So I'm Josh Sarnoff. I teach Indian intellectual property law clinic here, as well as patent law. I have a set of wonderful colleagues who teach intellectual property. Peter Yazzie, who focuses on copyright. Christine Farley, who is the associate dean, is amazing. In that capacity, he teaches trademarks. Nikki Phillips, who teaches communication law, and a range of other colleagues who border on the fringes of intellectual property, including antitrust. Also, who is running a program on information justice and intellectual property, and that acronym, information justice, actually reflects a conscious decision by our law school and by our intellectual property faculty to recognize the importance of human rights and of justice concerns in the information management and intellectual property field. The last point that David made about some of the intersections of people who are doing things and their civil and political rights really sets a context for some of the relationships between the intellectual property field and human rights. And I'll go over a little bit of kind of the history of that and then give you some kind of modern examples, because the concerns about human rights and intellectual property have really changed dramatically over the last few years. And we're witnessing a burgeoning of concern and interest, if not yet positive law and cases or other types of activities. But what does end up happening is that in the treaty space, where countries are negotiating what they are going to do under domestic law, these arguments, these concerns over human rights have had a tremendous effect over recent time. So some of the concerns historically have been, I would say, in kind of two general areas. The first area was there's actually in the economic and social rights space a concern that people who invent things, who create literature, who invent useful processes or objects for society, actually get the benefit of legal protection for what they created. And that that has been thought of as a human right, the protection of their mental products in some form. The other area where historically human rights have articulated articulated principles of law is in the area of political expression, information transfer, communication, as the right to be free from excessive censorship, the ability to express yourself. And I'll give a couple of examples of how that manifests itself in modern times and why that is such an important issue. But those concerns, which were primarily focused on protecting the individual, missed the basic concern of protecting society and people at large. And what has happened, I think, principally over the last 20 years, but even more dramatically over the last 10, has been an increasing concern for the rights of the public and the public's need of access to information in various ways. And I think it corresponds with a trend that you may hear from Danny toward a focus on positive rights rather than negative rights. Not restrictions on what people can do, but the need to provide things to people to empower them to live and fulfill their lives in ways that we find important. So let me give you a couple of examples of how this transition has happened. And before I even do so, these basic concerns about rights of access actually have been part of the intellectual property law domain, but they haven't been called human rights. before. So even in the core of copyright law, as reflected in some recent important Supreme Court cases in the United States, you find that there are basic principles, the idea that the ideas aren't protected and that people are free to express those ideas using new words, but people can't restrict the dissemination and use of other people's ideas. That's out there as a core principle of copyright law that's reflected throughout IP doctrinal laws in countries around the world. Similarly, let's get on to the copyright example, the ability to have a fair use, to criticize, using other people's copyrighted expression is something that protects the ability of people to express themselves in various ways and to make critical commentary, which previously was thought of as a censorship issue. But not a censorship made by the government directly, it's a censorship made by the owner of the content. So this is a way of assuring that copyright, through the exercise of enforcing legal principles in a court of law to prevent people from copying expression, doesn't restrict expressive communication, doesn't restrict freedom of people, doesn't result in censorship of political activity and other important social communication. So let me go back to probably the first and most important new development that people will readily recognize, and this is what's commonly called the access to medicines issue. Medicines are often necessary for people to live. Medicines, it turns out, are quite expensive. When they get protected by intellectual property rights, the medicines then cannot be produced, such as patents. The medicines can't be produced by generic manufacturers for significantly lower costs. You have monopoly rights, effective monopoly rights, so long as there's no good substitute for the medicine, to charge essentially whatever the market will bear. And it's been historically true that the large pharmaceutical companies have recognized that they have a competitive advantage in charging at a very high price, even though they're not serving all sorts of people who actually need the medicines. Sometimes they're willing to provide medicines at a humanitarian basis at very low cost, and when they do, we applaud. When we try to force them to do it, however, they complain bitterly. This is the compulsory licensing debate that the international institutions have gotten involved in. There's something called the World Trade Organization. How many of you have heard of the World Trade Organization? Good. How many of you have heard of the TRIPS Council? A few. The TRIPS Council is the part of the World Trade Organization that manages the section of regulatory law under the World Trade Organization's umbrella of laws that apply to what countries must provide as minimum intellectual property requirements in their countries. And one of the things that the World Trade Organization did through the TRIPS Council was to adopt what's known as the Doha Declaration, which said that even though we require countries to issue patents, particularly issue patents on pharmaceuticals, which is a premise of getting this TRIPS agreement. TRIPS is an acronym that makes no sense. The actual thing is the agreement on trade-related aspects of intellectual property, how they get TRIPS out of that, no one has the Doha Declaration basically says that we shouldn't have impediments to countries who want to issue compulsory licenses, so where there's both patents and manufacturing capability, so that they could then export those compulsorily licensed drugs at low cost to countries that don't have that capacity. And they adopted a declaration to let this happen. Very readily understood issue. Basic question is human right of medical care, access to quality of life, versus protecting what was used to be the rights of people in their expressive ideas. Here, the expressive idea being the information on which the pharmaceutical use has been developed. And, quite frankly, large amounts of investment in concrete clinical trials to make sure that this is safe and effective. It turns out that pharmaceutical development is a very expensive business. So everyone can readily see the conflict between human rights, on one hand, rights of access, and on the other hand, the rights of developers of information goods or physical goods based on information to provide things for social benefit. And it's a very hot conflict. that goes around the world, and there's no forum, really, for resolving these. You can go to individual countries. The World Trade Organization has a dispute resolution mechanism, but no one has actually tried to bring the case saying that where you've issued a compulsory license, you actually violate the TRIPS agreement in the World Trade Organization. We did try to do this recently in a developing country, and that developing country said, well, we just don't think this is the right forum for resolving the issue. Go see the TRIPS Council, and that hasn't happened. Another issue that comes up has to do with medical knowledge, accessing information. Here, copyright becomes a problem. Most people don't realize, well, you guys realize, textbooks are what?
Expensive,
right? So how many of you can afford to actually buy the textbooks to learn what we teach you in this school? This is really tragic. And you're in one of the, if not the wealthiest country, one of the wealthiest countries of the world. You go to other countries, even the universities can't afford the medical or other kinds of textbooks that are required to provide learning, much less so that the people who are practicing what they do can do so effectively and learn what they want.
It is my royalties, Josh.
You may need to make a humanitarian contribution. So one question goes to, how do we assure access to this information? And it's not just physical books on the Ubuntu demonstration model, such as this, look at that, right? Which it turns out are quite expensive, but also rights of access through this. Because it turns out that the internet, the rights of access to information through the internet is really critically important, but it can be distributed at very low cost. You need a scanner, and then you have the ability to disseminate information widely and reproduce it for almost no money, just the cost of either a hard drive or some other some bandwidth. Very low cost distribution and reproduction ability. The concern and what prevents you from doing it is the set of intellectual property laws around both copyright and digital rights management, to the extent that people were worried that these rights of access to information called fair use rights would prevent you from, or would allow people to readily distribute these things. Now they're locked up with technological protection measures, and there are national laws that prohibit the accessing of this information by disabling the technological protection measures. So how many of you have actually broken a technological protection measure to get access to information? Don't worry, the cameras are focused. Focus on me, I'm not saying. And for some people who not only do it themselves, but actually enable other peoples to break those kind of technological restrictions so that they could make what would otherwise be fair uses, they sometimes get locked up because they are assisting what is commonly viewed as piracy of the information. So there's a large rhetoric involved around the rights of access and whether the rights of access are really more like getting around unreasonable restrictions on what you can use, or really like stealing from somebody else or taking away their value that you're not entitled to. This is not the time, and I don't have the time to talk about that tension of what the best public interest approach to this is, or where the resolution of those rhetorical framings are. It's just to note that these are very hotly contested issues. Any of you who download these have done that. Other areas that this comes up, trademarks. In trademarks, there are some things which you guys are probably not as familiar with as the three people in the front because we're older, and these are called labor unions. Some of you will get this. Labor unions actually have some role in trying to do things like boycotts or other types of strikes, protest activity about other things, which you guys probably know a lot about, called companies. Companies tend to have assets and money to hire people, and then there's this interesting relationship about rights to work and things like that, which are the subject of traditional human rights law, whether you have a right to work, how that gets exercised if nobody's offering you a job. Leave those things aside for a minute. What if the company is doing something that you find objectionable and you want to tell people about? Well, the most effective way to tell it is to use a symbol that readily identifies who the company is, but you're using that symbol in a very critical way. And what's going to happen is you're going to get a suit trying to enjoin you from using the symbol critically. The symbol, it turns out, is a trademark. It's a trademark because it's signaling what the company is. It's a sign that identifies the company in the mind of the consumers. No one will be confused when I hold up this symbol and talk about free. How many of you know about fair trade and fair trade coffee? The good news is we now have it upstairs. And it's much better than the coffee used to be, so I'm really pleased. I drink all this. And the key is that there's this identifying symbol, and people can make parodies of the symbol. I don't know how many of you have seen the coffee whore symbol. Look it up online. It's quite funny. That would be a copyright issue. It also might be a trademark issue, but what if you're just a labor union and you say, you know, Starbucks shouldn't be going out and doing this stuff that hurts people around the world? You want to protest and hold up that thing, what is Starbucks likely to do? Although Starbucks might be more enlightened than sometimes if you're saying you can't use our trademark in this way because you're disparaging us or because you're lessening the goodwill that we have through the Consumers Association of our mark because you're saying bad things about us with our trademark. Have good legal grounds to do that under existing trademark law, but it's a human rights issue because it's the right to criticize, to engage in a form of political expression. So let me give you one other area that you may or may not have heard of, that might find the basic thing. It turns out I used to be an environmental lawyer for many years, and one of the areas that I've had the good fortune of interacting in is this new intersection between intellectual property and environmental law. So there's a treaty called the Convention on Biological Diversity. It turns out that the U.S. isn't a signatory to it, but what the Convention on Biological Diversity basically did was it said that genetic resources are not the common heritage of humanity as we used to think, but they're sovereign resources of the countries that where they're located. That meant that countries actually own the genetic resources and can make money from them. And the premise of going to this level of ownership was precisely to empower developing countries to restrict what people did with those genetic resources so that they could condition the access by scientists who would develop valuable products and sell them in other countries for their commercial markets. So and say, we should be entitled to a share of the benefits. If we own these resources, we can condition your access to them on your contractually agreeing to provide us with benefits. It turns out that there are other people involved. Typically, indigenous groups who have knowledge about what the resources are and what to look at. So there's a fascinating intersection about intellectual property and development and physical things that is coming out of the environmental law, going into the intellectual property law, and really reflecting a human rights concern of the rights of development of countries, which is getting played out in the TRIPS Council in various ways. There's something called the Disclosure of Origin Obligation, which has been tried to be introduced by a number of developing countries to try to say, look, when people take our stuff without our permission, our genetic resources, and turn them into patentable inventions, we should be obligated to at least say where they got the resources from so we can track if they have in fact gotten proper permission and therefore aren't stealing our resources and benefiting it from commercially from them commercially without sharing. Again, it's viewed as a development issue, an effort to empower the countries not only to raise their level of economic and social welfare, but also to value the genetic resources themselves well enough to protect them from encroachments from the ranchers and miners who would otherwise destroy the species, which you can ask David all about later.
Well, I'm Denny Brackman. I used to sign myself. international economic lawyer who works on development issues. And at any time again, I have to speak about human rights and business. I talk to you very queasy and uneasy about it because it's never quite clear to me what human rights and business is all about and what exactly the connection are. So let me explain a little bit of what I mean by that. Because on one hand, human rights and business seem very simple and very clear issues to deal with. I don't know if you read in the papers last week, there was Google was forced to apologize because it had turned over information to the Chinese government about a Chinese activist who had been using Google systems on the internet, and Google gave the Chinese government the information on what he'd been doing, and as a result, he'd been arrested and I think sentenced to many years in prison. Which seems like an outrageous abuse of human rights, both by the Chinese government, at least based on those facts, and by Google. And it seems like a really interesting and easy case of where human rights and business interact. There are many examples you can find like that which are very important. Just to give you one other example, there's a lawsuit that's been going on in South Africa for a number of years, which I think there's been one now, where South African workers were suing a British company that owned the company they worked at in South Africa because the company had allowed the workers to work on asbestos without telling them about what the risks of asbestos were. And as a result, they suffered all sorts of occupational health and diseases, including death. And they felt they were entitled, they should have been informed of what the company knew about asbestos and the risks that it had. And they were entitled to damages as a result of that. Also seems like a good example of a violation of their right to health and all sorts of other rights. But the reason it seems to me that human rights in business is such a complicated is because the whole way business has been set up, the whole way the economic system that we all live under is set up, is the business is separated consciously from human rights. So that the way businesses are set up, they're set up, if we start looking at private businesses, profit-maximizing entities. And then anything that slows down the making or complicates the making of profits interferes with business, and that's a bad thing for all of us because that means that there'll be less goods produced, less efficiently, which means we don't have less access to other sorts of things. And so that in a sense, and many conservative economists, and not really conservative economists, have said the function of business and their contribution to building human rights is to keep making profits and using those profits effectively. But it seems to me that if that's true, then the most important and the most outrageous human rights violation that I think exists in the world, which is the extreme poverty that exists all over the world, is written out of human rights altogether. Because what we're saying, in a sense, and to put it in maybe the most dramatic way, is how many of you think every time you go into a supermarket and buy something from Walmart or some other shop or some other company that's selling something to you at the lowest cost of production that they could do, that you're participating in a human rights violation? I'm impressed. How many of you don't buy it as a result? Because I think
also like a crowd.
But still, because I mean, I think that in a sense puts the dilemma of human rights and business in a very stark way. Because that's number one. Is that if we're dealing with poverty, and that we're participants in a system which produces extreme wealth at one end and extreme poverty at another end, we're all participants in a system of human rights abuses. And now, I grew up in South Africa under apartheid, and we used to spend a lot of time arguing about how you step out of the apartheid system and live a life that's a decent life in a system as equal as apartheid. And the truth of the matter is there's no way you can do it. I mean, and short of starving yourself to death, if you're going to buy food or you're going to buy clothing, you're part of that system and there's absolutely nothing you can do to avoid it. So that's at some level, when we think about human rights and business, we have to start from a very discomforting starting point, which is that at some level we're all participating in a system which, because of the fact that it produces such extreme poverty at one end and wealth at another end, is part of a human rights abuse system. So the question I always think about when I deal with human rights and business is how do you overcome that? And then it seems to me that the cases like the Google abuses in China are the easy cases. There's no debate that China, that Google shouldn't have done that. Companies do that sort of thing all over the world. And they do it not because they're not concerned about human rights or because they're bad companies necessarily, but that's because what the law requires of them. And as law students and as lawyers, it's hard for us to start with an argument saying we should violate the laws that uphold the societies that we live in, even when we think they're wrong. Because in some sense, if we keep violating laws, the legal system breaks down, and that's probably a worse situation for everybody. So that's in a sense of the easier cases. The harder cases for human rights and business is in a sense what Josh was saying, it's not so much that it's about human rights and business, it's about development and human rights. And when we talk about development, I would say one of the misleading ways of discussing development is to say that development is about what happens in poor countries and not what happens in rich countries. Is that all countries are developing countries? Because if you're not a developing country, you're a declining country, and I don't think any of us want to be living in declining countries. So when we talk about development, we're talking about the way in which goods and services are produced and the way in which we produce the societies we live in one country as well as around the world. When you put human rights, when you try to say, well, now that's a very grandiose statement, how do you go from that to something that is meaningful and operational in terms of human rights and business, or human rights and development? It's a very hard thing to do. I think human rights law doesn't do a very good job of addressing those issues, because it breaks human rights down into specific rights get dealt with discreetly. And then it adds on a statement which at one level I completely accept, which is that all human rights are co-equal, and that civil and political rights have no higher standing than economic, social, and cultural rights. That's all well and good, but on the other hand, what does it actually mean when you have to do something in practice? If a business were to come to us and say, look, I want to be completely human rights responsible, I want to do the exact right things to produce the best outcomes in terms of human rights, I don't think human rights lawyers or human rights activists actually have a very good answer, because they don't really know how you translate that. And so I have a couple of examples of where people are trying to thresh that out, where there are fora that are trying to deal with that, which open up some space to think about this. And I would say the starting point, I have two starting points, which you can agree or disagree with. One, as I said, is that I think poverty is the most outrageous human rights abuse in the world today. The second one is, I think the truth of the matter is we don't know, no one knows how you produce a human rights responsible society. I don't think anyone can say with any degree of confidence that the sequencing of human rights that's required for sustainable development should be, you begin with civil and political rights, and then you hope that that produces economic, social, and cultural rights, or the exact opposite. I don't know that anyone can say in that regard that a society like the United States, which puts a huge emphasis on civil and political rights, is any better at producing development than China, which has put a huge emphasis on economic and social rights, and has succeeded in reducing poverty more than any country in human history, which doesn't seem to be an insignificant achievement that we can just dismiss because of all the abuses which undeniably go on in China. So I think we have to begin with, the second point we have to begin with is a great degree of humility, that we don't actually know the answers, and that whatever we do is an experiment trying to work out the best possible answer. And let me give you three episodes, I guess, where these are being played out in ways which are interesting and which create interesting opportunities for us. And the first one is one in which David and I have been involved in, which is the inspection panel at the World Bank and the equivalent mechanisms at other which are places where people who believe they've been harmed by projects funded by the World Bank or the other regional banks can bring a complaint saying they want the bank to, within the inspection panel, to investigate the complaint to see has the bank complied with its policies and procedures in regard to that policy, into that project. And it becomes really an issue about development, hidden, and about development and human rights, hidden in a very technical procedural issue in a sense. Because what it becomes, ultimately, is a question about how do policies in the back that deal with issues like involuntary resettlements of people who have to be moved because of dams or highways or mines or whatever it is, how do people whose cultural property is about to be damaged in the course of development, how do their rights have to be factored into the development activities of the international financial institutions? And the case law that's growing out of that, much of which has been developed with the help of former students at this university, is becoming one of the places in which this debate gets played out within the context of specific cases. And so it's an interesting area to look at and an interesting area in which there's definitely opportunity. The second area to mention is the whole area of corporate social responsibility and the way in which companies are moving to show that they're more responsible companies. Now, they might be doing it for crude commercial reasons, but the fact is that, particularly driven by the environment, I think, even more than human rights, many of them are coming to realize that if they want to stay in business and they want to be viewed as an honorable company that people are proud to work at and that produce goods and services that people want to buy, they need to show that they're sensitive to the way in which the work that they do is responsible for the communities that are affected by that work and the environment that's affected by that work. And so there's a whole growing movement of corporate codes of conduct, which are now being developed from the sort of soft, gentle, non-enforceable codes of conduct into principles at the UN that are beginning to look a little bit more like law. We don't have too many fora yet where they can be enforced, other than in the courts of public opinion. But I think the trend is clear that there's going to be a development at some point in that regard. And the third area, which is, I'll just mention, because it's not a forum which lawyers can use in any way, but which the knowledge that was developed, I think opens up some very interesting ways of looking at human rights and at development. And that's the work that was done in the World Commission on Dams and the Extractive Industries Review at the World Bank. And what makes them so interesting, because as many of you know, dams are one of the most controversial types of projects developed around the world. I mean, you can only see the discussions about Three Gorges in China to have a sense of that. And about 10 years ago, I guess, the IUCN, for Conservation of Nature, and the World Bank, the dispute about dams has become so paralyzing in the world that we need to try and work out, is there some common ground between those who oppose dams and those who promote dams? And they called a meeting, and at the conclusion of the meeting, they agreed there was enough common ground that it was worth establishing a commission to look into this. And the commission is unique in international law because it was an organization, a body that was set up, worked hard for 2 years, came up with a report and went out of business, which never happened. But it came up with a report that on how you go about deciding whether to build dams or not. And the reason it's so important, and for those of you who are looking for research paper topics at some point, it's worth looking at, is that it's one of the first systematic attempts to integrate human rights, environment, and economic development into an operational framework that can be used really not just for dams, but all sorts of development activities. So I would encourage you to look at that, because I really think it's one of the more interesting human rights and development documents, which unfortunately is a victim of George Bush, because the report got issued between the date in 2000 when the election happened and the time that the Supreme Court awarded the election to Bush. This report got issued, and as you can imagine, there was absolutely no interest whatsoever at the time. But it's definitely something that's worth looking at. Our International Law Review has done one of the few law reviews to systematically look at it, so you might want to check that out as well. And the extractive industry is sort of a sequel to that in some ways. Not quite, but another interesting way of looking at it. So I think I'm still in time.
Yes, fantastic. So we have about 20 minutes for questions. I just wanted to raise one point before we open up to questions. Obviously, on the flyer, we had Sean Flynn named. That didn't mention the fact that Sean Flynn, unfortunately, couldn't join us. He's in South Africa at the moment. But Professor Sarnoff was so nice to agree to come last minute to fill in.
And that is that there are many things that individuals can do. You can do them when you get out as lawyers by participating in businesses and institutions. So one example is where Starbucks was opposing the geographical indication / trademark for Ethiopian yogurt. There's no reason that they had to have adopted that legal policy. And the theory is that getting a trademark would have increased the price that Ethiopian Gorbachev coffee could command, and therefore help the people who are actually so going out into the world, you can help to influence corporate social policies. Similarly, even while you are here, there are many things you can do in any of these areas, including with the International Law Review. I'll just make a plug for our program on information justice and intellectual property. And you can see just in domain. And what you can see from there is that we are engaged in various activities which try to develop capacity among various people, including individuals in the fair use context, including government negotiators in the trade context, also, and this is where it comes back to Sean and others developing choices of how antitrust and competition law can be used to restrain excessive uses of intellectual property rights that raise the cost of goods or prevent issuance of compulsory licensing. So that's why Sean being in South Africa right now here.
Also, before others have to leave, I wanted to give the panel opportunity to mention any upcoming classes in the spring that could be offered where students can learn more about these issues.
Sean teaches a course in intellectual property and human rights. The basic intellectual property courses are also available, and we talk about these issues there.
There's a course on investment, trade, and human rights that Professor Marcus Arellano teaches, which is a good place to discuss some of these issues. And for what's happened, of course, on human rights and environment as well, right?
I
have legal and rights. I have a question for my colleagues. While you guys are looking, plus, I didn't see any hands up. So, first off,
sorry, cut you off. I kind of wanted to pose a hypothetical because I think it might touch on both. I mean, all three of business and environmental and IP issues. So I was reading a lot about alternative forms of energy, and scientists not tomorrow but hopefully soon might be able to synthesize an enzyme to break down cellulose, and thus we have it's going to take a while for the distribution to get any good, but we might be able to get basically unlimited forms of energy from plants from that. But I just kind of wondering, there's so many issues with that. Should that scientist get a patent for that, such a big invention of that, such as that? Or, is that a workable business model if they don't? And is that, a human rights or environmental issue that, humanity is entitled to, that a discovery such as that could, put fossil fuels out of use forever?
The short answer is it's a terrific question. There are a couple of professors, myself included, who have been thinking about global warming and incentivizing technological developments. And it raises precisely the question, as soon as somebody really develops something that's incredibly useful, do they get a 20-year from filing date patent to charge whatever the price will be? The good news is that under the Clean Air Act, there is a provision providing for compulsory licensing of environmental technologies that could be deployed because there is no general compulsory licensing authority. There's the ability to use marketing rights if the invention were made with federal funding. But the bottom line is the question poses precisely the right tension, which is you want to incentivize the production by providing some type of super competitive reward to people if they invent this great idea. And at the same time, you want to make sure it is so widely disseminated at low cost immediately that it conflicts with the incentive mechanism. So there's been development, and this is also part of the trade negotiation discussions, of mechanisms for incentivizing such technological development that don't require granting exclusive rights, such as prize funds. And it's now the subject of Nobel Prize winning economists' activities.
Okay. I mean, just because it raised interesting human rights issues from a development point of view, because a lot of this biofuels, I mean, it's great in many ways. It's saving the environment. It's dealing with the problem of fossil fuels. But it's using land that grows food, which means it's a serious, I mean, we were just talking earlier today that the price of wheat has been going up in the world, and there have been food riots in a number of countries around the world. Now, I'm not saying that it's directly correlated to the price of biofuels. It's related to a lot of other things. But as we buy more into biofuels, that means more land will be taken out of food production, and that is going to have a serious impact. I don't know what the answer is, because, I mean, they're clearly two very difficult and important problems, but it's why I think you have to have so much humility in these areas.
Are there any sources, newspaper or magazine, where we could keep up with the development in the field?
Washington Post. These issues are in the news all the time. It's just keeping your eye out for it, quite frankly. If you are looking at it from either a development perspective or freedom of information perspective, you read all of those articles about what's going on very differently.
No, I mean, I hate to sound like a hacker for some newspaper, but I think the best newspaper is the Financial Times, for instance, of the mainstream media. I mean, I think sometimes you can't stick just to the mainstream media, but in terms of if you're looking for one newspaper that covers a lot of these issues, that for my money is the best one.
Because Danny is often in there as a
The other place is again, one of the wonders of the internet is that the information is much more readily accessible from intergovernmental organizations and non-governmental organizations. So the UN Commission on Trade and Development has a very good source of thinking about these kinds of issues. WIPO clearly has this information. The CTSD is another organization. Lots of different sources you can go to that do analyses, issue reports, provide recommendations for development.
Yeah, I would start with the web in whatever particular area, but depending on, because, you know, it's sort of broad and there's also very specifics. But one thing, you know, for those of us who are into these issues, there are often listservs that are designed specifically, you know, I'm on a climate listserv that comes out once every 2 weeks, it gives me all the updated climate policy. And without it, I'd be lost. It's changing all the time. And it would include that there are listservs on human rights and business. There are listservs on, you know, different aspects. So as you get into it, you know, kind of keep an eye out for how you join those, because some of them are routinely sending out newsletters and other things like that. Other questions? Do I get to ask my question? Well, I wanted Danny to mention another place where human rights and business is, I think, being discussed right now, which is the Ruggie report process. I'm taking a role of moderator. I've seen you follow it more closely than I do. Would you like me to say that? Maybe you should say that. Well, you can correct me when I'm wrong, but this dialogue around business and the human rights led the UN subcommittee on human rights to look at what the norms, the business, came up with after a 3-year process something called business norms for human rights, and it was trying to do what Danny said, which was it was trying to take the human rights documents and make it relevant for business. But the problem, actually, at the end of the day, was it probably didn't do a very good job of it, and it probably wasn't very defensible from the perspective, even though a lot of us liked it when it came out. It was criticized, so it got kicked over to a special, I don't know what its title is, but a special process, instead of just being completely kind of put down to rest because the governments weren't going to be able to adopt it, the United States blocked it and some others, they kicked it over to a process being led by a guy named John Ruggie, R-U-G-G-I-E. And he's now spent 2 years studying the relationship between human rights and business to try to come up with a different approach or a set of reports around the relationship and what business obligations are with respect to human rights, if any. And his report is due out shortly, but his interim reports have come out as well. He's really I don't know how good it's going to be, but he's developed a process and a lot of people are writing things for this process. There's a lot of publications that have been created out of it, exploring these kind of tough issues that Danny was saying. And you can look for that report to come out probably by spring on different aspects of what we would expect business to do in the international context. That was a good answer.
There's also a fabulous report that was put together by the United Kingdom, using as their chairperson actually a U.S. patent lawyer, Mr. Andrew John Gordon, the Commission on Intellectual Property Rights, which focused on the relationship between the IP system and development explicitly. It's really a seminal work, which has led to, I think, a number of different changes and innovations, both in the international sphere and at the domestic level.
Well, if there are no more questions, any other questions? No? Okay, if you'll join me in thanking our panelists.